Welcome to Assembly Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs building on the Salesforce platform. We'll go behind the scenes with innovative founders and leaders to share their stories, strategies, and lessons to accelerate your own path to success as a Salesforce ISV. Are you struggling to make sense of the Salesforce security review? It's the number one roadblock slowing down your AppExchange launch. Security Review Partner translates those complex reports into a simple, prioritized checklist. Stop deciphering jargon and start shipping faster. Get the clear, step-by-step guidance you need to pass the review with confidence. Simplify your path to market. Visit securityreviewpartner.com today. That's securityreviewpartner.com. Hi, everyone. Before diving into today's conversation, I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge we'll be touching on a sensitive topic. Chris bravely opened up about a very challenging period in his own life, including struggles with depression and thoughts of self-harm. This is a powerful and important story, especially because mental health is often so neglected in the startup world, but I understand that it might be difficult for some viewers and listeners. For anyone that may be facing serious struggles of their own, please remember you are not alone and help is available. You can connect with compassionate and trained individuals by calling or texting the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Just dial 988 to reach them anytime, day or night. Calls are free and confidential. Thanks. And with that said, please enjoy my conversation with Chris. So I'm joined today by Chris Federspiel of Blackthorn. Welcome, Chris, to Assembly Line.
Yeah, Scott, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. So I guess, you know, I know you've been on the AppExchange a long time, but for those listeners that might not be aware, would you mind just giving us some background on Blackthorn? I know you actually have a few apps, but maybe you could tell about their focus, you know, the folks you're targeting, what the app does, who it's for, and the problems they solve.
Yeah, we are a event management platform for Salesforce. We're natively built. You can think of us like Cvent or Eventbrite, but living inside of Salesforce. And our stack is comprised of our events app, our payments app, and our messaging app. So if you process a whole heck of a lot of payments, you want to do that out of Salesforce, you can use us. If you do a whole ton of SMS, you can use us. But kind of like a transformer, they all kind of combine to work with our event stack. And we primarily work with education, nonprofit, and healthcare, but we've bridged a bit further into financial services like banking and insurance. We have some manufacturing, and we are kind of unique because we are processing millions of registrations per year, and there's literally hundreds of thousands of events that are hosted per year, not in like the conference space, more of events as like infrastructure, you know, a whole huge host of free events.
Wow. That's cool. I like that architecture too, of kind of a Lego or a transformer model, I think is what you said, but different components, but they can all, so customers can pick and choose what they actually need. Maybe they don't need payments or they just need the event management. They can go with that.
Yep, exactly.
Cool. And so do you have separate AppExchange listings for all of these, or is it one listing and they choose kind of to upgrade to different tiers?
Yep. We do have different listings. Technically, Events has a dependency on our payments app. And when you install, we made candyshop.blackthorn.io. So we script the whole thing. You don't have to install in like specific order. We have a base package. Our messaging app can be used standalone, but we also have a base package that works with that using some features that are kind of shared across them. So we do have different AppExchange listings, and that's effectively for advertising. But technically, you can just install them from our one page. You click one button and it installs them all.
Nice. And was there one app that got things going that, or I'm assuming the events app?
So we started in 2015. Our payments app was the first one that was on the AppExchange in 2016. We had our events listing up very early, but it did very little until like late 2019. It was mostly like a combination of lead capture mixed with talking to people and getting feedback about what to build. Payments grew to a few million ARR, but then events like really took off, and that has become like our main platform.
Very cool. So you said It started taking off late 2019. Obviously, March 2020, COVID hits. Did you see a scale back, I assume, in the events for a little while?
Because we have never really filled the large conference space, we didn't really get hit that badly. We very quickly added integrations to Zoom, GoToMeeting, GoToWebinar, WebEx, and then Zoom has, even though it's one name, it's like two APIs with Zoom Meetings and Zoom Webinars, but we quickly added those in, which really helped. And then some people still had some in-person stuff, like some campus tours sometimes. They weren't exactly in-person all the time, but sometimes they were. Some nonprofit things continue to be in-person. But we didn't have like a scale back. We didn't see attrition. The only time we saw attrition is if a company went out of business as a result of COVID, which they were like low single digit that happened to us, maybe two or three or something.
I see. Okay. So you launched the first app in 2015. Is that also when you launched the company? Were you in services before then or?
Yeah. So my first Salesforce job was early 2011 at what is now Vacasso, doing service cloud related apps and services. And I got sales, service, admin, dev, sales and service cloud certs in the first, like, I don't know, 10 or 11 months from hopping on the platform in early 2011. I was first 100 service cloud certified. Nice. But I really like, you know, being an admin effectively, or essentially. And I was there for 2 years and then I went to Silverline, which has some new name now, which I don't really remember the name. I don't know. They're in New York. They mostly do financial services. Is there a year and a half? And then I started what is now Plaitiv, and I partnered up with Nishad early on. And then I wanted to do something with apps, and that became Blackthorn. So that was almost at 10 years now. So that was like August 2015. And we launched the payments app in early 2016. It was just an integration to Stripe. It mostly just did a charge and a refund out of Salesforce. Didn't have any custom UIs or anything.
Interesting. So you're coming up on the 10-year anniversary. Congrats on that.
It's both congrats and not congrats. It's some of it's been very long and enjoyable. Some of it's been quite tough.
The life of a founder, right?
Yeah.
So I guess for context, then could you give folks like an idea of where your current state is in terms of revenue, size of team, customer count?
Yeah. We're coming up on 18 million of ARR. We don't have any services revenue, so that's all subscription. We have 110 employees, maybe. We're all remote. We don't have an office. There's 600 customers and change, something like this. And we're hoping to add 4 to 5 million this year of revenue. We'll see. Focused on events in our key verticals.
It's just still growing at a nice clip. Was there a consulting project that initially led to the development of the payments app, or how did that?
Yes, that is exactly what happened. So when I was running the company, which is now Plaitiv, was originally CRM Passport. I implemented Chargent, Linvio, and I think I played around a bit with Kultura. And I found that none of them integrated with Stripe at the time. And Stripe was like up and coming. And I was like, okay, I want to work with Stripe. Mm-hmm. And then a few things I wanted to do out of the box, they were not possible in those apps yet. I think they're all possible now, but they weren't possible yet. So I was like, okay, I want to make this app so that the services company can do the implementation work for the app. And I ended up starting this company with another guy. I bought out my co-founders in 2018, and that didn't end up happening with like the apps and services kind of mixed that way. But it did come out of the origination of wanting to do payments that had more out of the box. And my co-founder at the time wanted to do the same thing with events. But events ended up being a much longer journey because everyone thinks events is like kind of easy, just like throw up a landing page and you do a registration, but it has a wild amount of features that people ask for. And that just has taken a very long time to build.
I think the same is true of payments in general too. I think nowadays people think, you know, just integrate with Stripe. What more could be involved? But I know there's a lot involved
There's a
in
lot of
that.
routes. Some people do payments in person, some send a link, some kind of want like API connection from their site. They want to be able to send money. They want something niche with ACH. They want to work with some gateway that is like very small, but they have to use it for some reason. So even though you have a payments app, there's like many times when we can't do something and we'll send them over to another one of the ISVs or vice versa or something like that. So yeah, it just varies.
Well, so di and in the early days, did you do any further validation for your app the app when you're getting started that there was going to be a real market fit, or was there just
No.
enough
No.
to
I mean, we knew that Eventbrite was very big, and we knew that Cvent was very big. And we knew that Salesforce had many thousands of customers. So we're like, okay, so we know that like there's a lot of people that are doing payments, a lot of people doing events. It's not really on Salesforce in a big way, so there's probably something there. But we had no vertical thesis. We just knew technically some ways that we could make it a bit easier because we approached it from a tech perspective rather than a sales perspective. A lot of the other apps were developed primarily by people who are like really good at go to market. Like Fontiva, they were very good at go to market and the sales function. Chargent, same thing, very good at go to market and the sales function. Conversely, I'm horrible at go to market and the sales function, but really like focus on the admin side. So I've had to hire for those gaps eventually.
One thing just switching gears a little here. I know that I believe anyways, Blackthorn to date has not had any VC funding. Is that still the case?
Sort of. So in, oh, I'm getting all the years confused now. I don't know, three years backwards from now, we did a debt facility. So we did a big debt round, which is
That I knew
kind of
about, right.
that. Yeah, there's no VC. I'm the only board member. It's kind of niche in the way that we're funded. But we didn't do that for a long time until we hit scale. We hit like 8 million and change ARR, and then went for money to just go a lot faster. Our events app was like very unstable at the time. It went down all the time. We had tons of bugs, and we needed to make the engineering team much, much bigger, much faster than our revenue could support with our expenses. So we burned funds for a while we ramped up engineering primarily, and then we used some of the money for like sales and marketing related stuff. But it was mostly to ramp engineering. And at the time, I also then bought Texty, which is now Blackthorn Messaging, and that was done out of debt as well.
Okay, because I believe you prior to that you'd also done a little revenue based financing,
Yes.
and I wanted to just ask you about the debt facility and also the revenue based financing, because I think a lot of founders just kind of think there's two options, right? Of just bootstrap 100% or fundraise through a VC, and I know that Blackthorn kind of took the path less traveled, and so I thought it would be valuable to hear like that there are other options out there, and so maybe you could talk a little bit about the revenue-based financing.
Yeah, I mean, if that's a more open question, I'll just tell you the order we went in. We almost died in 2018, so a friend gave us 50K, and then a family member helped pitch in to buy out my co-founders. But then we still had like 8K in the bank account with an 80K, no, 7K in the bank, 7 or 8K in the bank account, and then an 80K monthly outflow. So that was like a disasters. Then we had to hustle to make a lot of moves to like cut expenses in different ways. It wasn't like we only had like 12 people. I think I let like three people go. So it wasn't like that much savings there. Like it had to come in a lot of other ways. And then we accelerated revenue in a lot of other ways too. There was a whole bunch of moves we made there, which I'm happy to get into if you want to get into that. But then in 2019,
Yeah, definitely.
yeah, let's come back to that. So in 2019, all the employees had options and then they wanted to own even more. So we did an employee round. And that raised like 180K. And I don't remember how many employees we had at that point then, maybe 15 or something. And they brought in like their friends and family members, but they just bought under themselves. So they're the only ones on the cap table. So that raised some money. And then I wanted to see what was out there for doing a raise because I didn't want to have a board, only because I just heard so many bad stories about boards. And since being in this position now, like, there really are like good and bad boards. There's some that really push you to like places you don't want to go, and there's some that are like very supportive and help you get like the skills to fill in your experience gaps. But this is like, you know, in hindsight. So I talked to a few of the revenue-based financing ones, and I talked to CapChase, and they were able to give us a pretty good facility to do this. And they initially, all these models have matured over time. They were all kind of new then. So now they can do like multi-years of interest only. But at the time, it was like a 12-month payback. And I was like, guys, this sucks. This isn't like how our model works. This isn't going to work. So they changed it to like a 2 or 3 year payback, and we did a refinance. And then when I went to buy the Texty app, that deal was a down payment and then ramping up payments over 2 years. So they helped with the down payment, and I financed that part. And then around that same time, since we had like a revenue base, at that time, it was a lot easier to raise from angels. So I reached out to a lot of people that I knew to get intros to other people I didn't know, to get them to be able to invest in the company. People that are in the ecosystems and Salesforce, people that are not in the ecosystem, they introduced me to other people. So we raised like a million of angel funds, which are great because they act as advisors. Plus they're not forcing you to have a board. There's no like governance. There's no liquidation preference. There's like 1x preferred shares, which just means, you know, if they put in a million, they get back a million first before anyone else gets paid. It's just like a downside protection, but it doesn't like double their take or anything like that. So I was like, okay, that's very fair. That sounds great. So we ended up doing a second one of those eventually for another like 400 or 500K. The downside of doing all these raises is that it's very time consuming. So if I had to do this again, I'm not sure that's how I would do it, because it just does take a lot of time. But I actually don't know what I would do. And it was sort of safe, and we paid, I think, 8K to AngelList, I think, to manage it all. And that was, it's very good money spent to deal with all that. But then I wanted us to like really go a lot faster. And at the time we had something like 55 VCs that reached out that all wanted to do a growth round, and they all wanted to put a board in place. Only one of them didn't want to do a board, but they had like a ton of structure that I didn't really want to do. And so I ended up looking at doing a debt round, which is not all debt. There's like a few points of equity, and then it was like a 4-year interest only debt round. So the facility grew over time to be like a 20 million facility, something like this. So even though it sounds like a lot of money, a lot of it gets locked because you have to maintain a certain minimum amount of cash on the balance sheet, which is like their own protection. So like, you know, a few million gets frozen. So like it's not as much as it sounds. And then also you have to pay for the servicing, because there's interest every month. So that tends to add up too. But the upside is that if you end up with a big exit, their upside is fixed. If you end up with a small exit, that's better to have percentage-based investing, because then you'll end up doing better. So it really just depends, quite frankly. I think in hindsight, if we had done well enough, like a big seed round would have been awesome, because then they don't necessarily impose the board structure. You get the financing, it's percentage based. But also that tends to be 15 to 20%, right? And this whole debt facility, it equates to be like, it's relative to the exit size, but yeah, it varies. So that's more or less how we went about financing the company. In terms of what we did to get revenue early on, the payments app was free initially. So I messaged all of our customers. I said, you can stay on your current version perpetuity and we won't turn it off. But if you need support, if you want to upgrade, literally anything, then you have to pay us. And I did not make the app expensive enough, but it did have us get like 80K ARR, like right away, which is, you know, 1 month of expenses.
What kind of conversion did you have? Sorry to interrupt, but what kind of conversion did you have from that email?
I think currently we have low single digit people that are still free. Our attrition, maybe one that like left because of it. Pretty much everybody stayed. Like it was infrastructure. We weren't charging. I didn't charge nearly enough. I think that's why.
I think so many founders say that. They're like, I don't know. They just feel bad asking for money for way too long. And then they do. And they're like, I should have asked for more and I should have asked for it sooner.
I think it's a technical founder problem because you know how long it took to make it. And so you charge relative to the amount of time it took to make it, which is not actually how much you should charge. You should charge to make significant profit on your expenses, because then that will help fuel the growth. And I didn't understand that at the time. And also, companies either are very busy and they're not going to do your thing, or they just don't have the technical ability or people available to even do it. And it's worth like just spending. So then we had a bunch of customers that were paying monthly, and I said, hey, I'll give you a 10 or 20% discount if you pay us annually today. And they're like, okay, yeah, of course. That's like a no-brainer. We launched the events app, and that started to bring in some revenue eventually. I was able to get another customer to do a new services project with us. We did a lot of services projects early on, but they ended up being like pretty sizable. We had like 6 or 7 people on the team, but the services projects were anywhere from 50 to 300K each. So that's like a good size relative to the team size.
That is nice.
That really helped.
It can eat away your focus though, right?
All the projects we did contributed to our managed packages. We purposefully took stuff that was in like event and payment world, but of course a lot of stuff was distraction. So we made a lot of custom stuff that didn't end up making it into the packages, because it was like, it was too niche, or in order to get it into the package, it would have been too structured. And like, we had an attendee mobile app in 2017, and we ended up sunsetting that in 2019. And only earlier this year did we finally rebuild it and release it. Now we have Blackthorn Navigator, and that it is an entirely different infrastructure to do it. And a big thing I've learned is doing things at scale are so different than when something is small. Like our payments app, like, I know I'm going like on a tangent here, but
this is great.
We had a few disasters with our payments app. There was one customer that's now actually no longer in business, not because of us. Their business model ended up not working, but it was a subscription company, and they wanted to use our app to do subscription charges, which it's very different from recurring billing. Recurring billing is an engine that is easy to put together. If you want to, however, do things like proration and get into all the subscription logic, that is really a lot of logic. And I mean, now like AI can probably help you develop it pretty fast, but at the time, like it was not that fast. And so we had Salesforce, as you know, had lots of weird limitations. And so you can only do like a certain number of callouts at a time. And if for some reason the result of a call out doesn't get a response, like the record can roll back and not store the result. So it looks like the record hasn't been touched. Or if there's a query, you can get a rollock error and so forth. So we had a series of, we had an overnight process that was running, and it charged all the customers. And the process was picking up it was a 5-minute process running on a batch that was picking up an array of like 100 or a few, however many like we could do as an array in the batch. It was using like a flex queue or something. I don't remember what it was using. And Stripe doesn't take array charges. You had to do one by one by one by one by one. And even still, they don't support it. Probably avoids problems. So this thing, what was happening is that it wasn't getting through all the charges within the 5 minutes. And so the next 5-minute batch would come around, and it would pick up the ones that hadn't concluded and hadn't gotten an update on the record. So some people were charged like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And this created a mess because we had to do exports from Stripe to get all the unique identifiers of the charges. And at the time, we weren't even passing the Salesforce record ID. So we had like nothing to match it on. Like we had like maybe the amount that people were charging, and sometimes we had the name, but sometimes the amount, they would have like 50 of the same amount in the same night. So it was such a disaster. So we ended up fixing that for them that day. And then I swear to you, the same thing happened that night. Like we fixed the bug, we rolled out a prop, like we deployed a new package. We did all this within a few hours, right? And then we found a new problem that caused almost the same problem to happen the next day. Oh my God, this is the worst day. I sat in their office the entire day with this other guy, and the two of us just went through spreadsheets with VLOOKUPs and rolling things back and refunding customers. And I was on the phone with our dev who was in Pakistan, who I couldn't get in touch with. And this was like, oh my God, what a mess. What a mess. And such a disaster. Well, the customers at the time were, most of them were nice about it. Their CFO like screamed at me. I was like, oh my God. I mean, it wasn't unwarranted, but the screaming, I don't know, that was a bit much, but that was a very hard time.
Oh man, that sounds really
rough.
There were a lot of these. Building an AppExchange business can be isolating. Are you tired of guessing what the right next move is to grow and scale? Don't go it alone. ISV Forge surrounds you with a curated group of fellow ISV founders who are on the same journey. We combine peer accountability with expert-led weekly webinars to help you overcome roadblocks and build a thriving business. Stop guessing and start scaling. Apply for the next cohort today at isvforge.com. That's isvforge.com. It's nice to hear that a lot of people, you go on LinkedIn and you just see all these like charts of growth and founders talking about, you know, it's just hockey stick growth to the moon. It's pretty easy. You know, 3 months in, I was hitting 10 mil ARR. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So it's refreshing to hear some real stories of what a roller coaster ride it really actually is like.
It was a mess. Look, we didn't have 300K. We hit 300K ARR after being in business for 3 years. And then after that, the next year we hit 1 million and then like two. And then it then like quickly went up to like 15 or 16. And then the last year was, the last few months have started to get better. But the last year before that, when interest rates rose, like everything slowed down. Like nonprofit buying really slowed. Education has continued, but a lot of, I don't know how many SI founders you talk to, but almost every SI has been flat or maybe 5 or 10% growth, and almost all the ISVs have been the same, because a lot of Salesforce's new logos have massively slowed down. Like most of their growth has been from other products, but Salesforce is not seeing churn. So all the customers they have, they're staying on. So now our new focus has been tapping the existing customer base rather than SIs bringing us new projects. So we have relationships with a ton of SIs. They're great. They're huge supporters of us. We don't do any of our own services. So it's like a very mutual, symbiotic, that's what I was looking for, relationship. But they primarily function on new logos. So our new go-to-market is now all about going after the existing customer base. And we're actually starting like a massive cold calling based initiative tomorrow. And there's a ton of tech and there's a big go-to-market behind that. And I know this is another tangent and then we'll go back to whatever questions you have. One thing I super downplayed was how much work it takes to make a go-to-market. I'm like, oh, that's a BS term. It's not a real thing. This is like baloney. But it's an actual.
The only thing that's hard is the app, right? The building the business is easy, right? Building the app is the hard part. That's what technical founders, I think that's one trap, right? That a lot of technical founders fall into is they think that the code is the hard part.
It's so much. And look, AI is very fast at accelerating the build of new apps. It is not making go to market magical. You need to have a great app. And yeah, you can do like all this cool stuff with Clay and all these automation tools. And there's like so much stuff there. But still, there's a lot of value to brand and to like your network. And there has to be like some intro viral effect that gets things going. And it's very hard to do that guerrilla style. So that's been like a long learning for me.
Well, you said, so I know you just said less so now, but at least initially, SIs were a huge part of your go-to-market. How did you get that engine started? Just reaching out cold, I mean, basically cold calling to the SIs, or did you already have a network from your consulting days?
It's a number of paths. So I knew a few from our consulting days, but like Coastal Cloud and Huron and Attain and Cloud for Good, like I don't know any of these people. So we had the apps on the App Exchange, and admins, the consultants, they would get a project and they would like get our app. And I would just see whoever came in through the App Exchange and get on the phone and say, hey, you're at a SI, can I like do a lunch and learn for you? And at the time, some of them were still in person. So I would go in person and meet them all and just give them exceptional support, like whatever they needed. Hey, we have this project. Great. Let's get on the phone. Let's scope it. We'll help you build it. We'll do some of the services. You can charge. Don't care. We won't charge. Maybe we'll sub some out if like it's really extensive. But the partners, what they really want, they don't really want money back. We've probably sent 4 or 5 commission checks in our history. They want to remain impartial to the client. They much more value an app that works with a team that is easy to work with, both sales and technical. And so a lot of the relationships either came from AppExchange inquiries, or I would talk to Salesforce reps when somebody came in and they would bring me into the SI, or I would ask the customer that came in from the AppExchange, hey, can you intro me to your Salesforce rep? And they always do. Can you intro me to your SI partner? And they always do. And then from there, you have to push for like the lunch and learn. They all have these, you know, every Friday, every other Friday, they'll have like a half hour, hour session that people could join to learn about some new whatever. And it was probably easier then because the number of ISVs has like really grown since 2015. And even at that time, they're already a good bit, but it's probably harder to enter in the market that way. But still, like, you can't beat personal connection. If you can physically go in person to Salesforce offices, once you get a relationship with a single rep, your own rep, just go in and offer to talk to them and then talk to their team. And just say, hey, can I come in and meet your team? I'll buy you breakfast or whatever. And I'll, you know, can you intro me to your manager? Like, who's your SE? Can I talk to your SE? And you get in with the SE teams. And then it helps a lot to be vertically focused because those teams are a lot tighter. So you'll meet the SE for someone in education and they're like a IC. And then you meet their manager and then you meet their manager's manager. And then you end up doing like different pockets of presentations. And they'll say, hey, you should meet this SI and this SI. And like, there isn't any wizardry to it. It just takes really, really a lot of time. It's a lot of reaching out, a lot of phone calls, a lot of dinners. It's like, it's a lot of hustle.
I believe it. I think a lot of folks get their AppExchange listing live and they think that the deals will start rolling in. And specifically, they think the Salesforce partnership means Salesforce is going to be doing a lot of selling on their behalf and that the AEs are just going to roll the red carpet right to their door. And yeah. I think I've always heard, you know, but getting those connections you're talking about, that's the holy grail for an ISV. If you can do that, and it's people always wonder, like, how do you make these connections? It sounds like you just got to do boots on the ground and you got to put in the work.
Yeah. Look, if you go to like the events that they have, just stop by the SI booth, you know, hey, I'm Chris, here's our app. Is there somebody on your team I could talk to? Can I present to your team? Okay. You know, they're all very nice people. With our partner team, like we pay them over $1 million a year, Salesforce, as our like rep share fee thing. And they don't like, our partner manager doesn't like drop leads on our plate. Like this is not what happens. What they're very good at is we will ask to get us in touch with someone and they'll do the intro. So we'll have a prospect that came in from who knows where, a demo, a booth visit, like you name it. Hey, can you put me in touch with the Salesforce AE? They'll do that all day long. You can't ask for like 300 of them. But if you ask for like, you know, we have like a dedicated manager in America and we're like paying some money. But if you're a new partner and you're not paying them anything, you can still ask like, hey, can you intro me to this AE? And they'll do it. Depending upon who you get, it might take them a little while and you might need to like really ask because you know, some people are hungrier than others or just care more. I don't know what it is, but through the years, we've had some that have been significantly more attentive than others. But then once they intro you to the AE, then like floodgates can open for your possibilities. Can I talk to your team about our app? Can I come in and bring bagels for breakfast? And then you fly to that office and then you do that. And then you ask each AE, which SI partner do you work with? Because they all work with three of them. Hey, can you intro me to your main contact at the SI partner? Yeah, sure. And they'll do that. And then there's a lot of pay to play. Like if you can get in with the AEs, just say, hey, let me do like a happy hour tonight. And they all show up. Like, or maybe not everybody, you know. If somebody has kids or lives somewhere else, they're not going to show up. But if they're just like individuals, they'll show up to the happy hour and you'll get to meet them and you'll get a relationship. And, you know, if you're an SI, then you'll start to get some projects. They'll start you off when they're like smaller ones they don't really care about. But it's a way to like build trust. If you're ISV, like you have to, depending upon what your app is, the AEs generally won't care. All they're going to remember is like, oh, Chris has an events app. That's all they're going to remember ever. Yeah. And
maybe the Danish.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
The Danish you brought in.
yeah, maybe. So you have to keep doing it because over and over. So every 4 to 6 months, you do it again. And there's over 10,000 Salesforce reps. So there's no shortage of like these things you could be doing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's good advice. Everybody just thinks like you can just quickly turn it on and you'll get all these deals, but it's good to know you're gonna have to get on a plane, trains and automobiles in order to get to these offices to do these lunch and learns.
It works the best. You don't have to, but that works the best.
No, I think more so than ever too, as AI kind of accelerates all these like bot interactions, right? I think more and more the human interaction is going to be more refreshing to folks. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, agreed.
So, I want to go back to something you mentioned. I think you said you had at one point, and you said you had like 7K in the bank, 70 to 80K outflow. And I know you went into some of the tactics you did to turn things around by, you know, turning around the customer saying, if you want to keep upgrades, you're going to have to pay, et cetera. But I wanted to ask, like, it sounds like this is the time when you also bought out your partner with the financing. I think your co-founder.
Just
before that. Okay. So, did you ever have thoughts of maybe it was time to just shut down Blackthorn?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm surprised, you know, okay.
Of course.
How close did you come to making that decision? I'm very curious because it sounds like...
I mean, the decision almost made itself for me. Daunting. Like, you know, if you... how many payrolls can you miss before your business closes? I don't even know the answer. Like, I asked our team to take voluntary pay reductions and a bunch of them did. I say, hey, I'll pay you back whatever you gap, plus I'll pay you a bonus and I'll give you more options like if you stay. And we had to do that two or three times in the company's history. But that first one like really helped. And most of them are still here.
Did anyone leave when you asked that? Or
no,
did everyone stay?
Wow. Everybody stayed. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a unique person that joins a 10-person company. And you have to make sure you get that person. You can't get them coming out of a big company. Like it will not work. This is not a 9 to 5. This is like 8 to 8, and then something breaks on the weekend, every third weekend. Like it's just it's hard. But I thought about closing it all the time. I couldn't sleep. I was on multiple sleeping drugs, talking to a psychiatrist. I was having suicidal thoughts. I was sitting at a table crying. Like I have like a picture I hate looking at with like a tissue box. It was like disaster. But like I had to work while I was like crying. And I was staying at a friend's place, and like he came over, and I was like, oh man, I'm in a bad place. It was such a horrible time, and to endurance sports for a while, and I brought my bicycle to San Francisco. At the time, I was in the Launch Accelerator. They gave us 100K, and that helped a lot. They have a lot of the company now. I think they still have like 5% of the company for 100K, which is a very good deal that they got. Jason Calacanis got a very good deal. But I ended up pitching Blackthorn for 12 weeks in San Francisco. I don't live in San Francisco. I live in New York. And I was married, who's now my ex-wife, remarried with the kid now. But that was a whole long thing when I was flying back and forth and staying there for 2 weeks and then flying back while the company's not working, while we're going out of business. And I was pitching 8 to 9 investors every week, and I would pitch something different. I pitched events, I pitched payments, I pitched mobile payments, I pitched events and payments. And there's no one wanted to. It was over 100 investors that I pitched. No one wanted to do it at the time. And so I had another friend who was living in SF, and he was very into meditation. So we would like go meditating at night. I was like, dude, I am not doing well. And we go to like the Palace of Fine Arts. I don't know if you've been there. It's a super pretty thing. It's like,
it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. So we were there at night, and I would just like sit on the beach and just like meditate and just like stare out into the water. And like, I was like in the abyss of death. And I would go home and work. And the next day I was working. It was just like, it's such a hard time. And so my prior services company, though, I sold my interest to Nishad, and it was like heartbreaking to me, because I had given a year and a half of my life. This was 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and then like Sunday a few hours for a year and a half. Like that, it is like I've never worked that hard. And then I sold my interest, and I felt like, wow, I didn't realize I could put in so much effort to get such little reward, and then it's gone. And so when this was happening with Blackthorn, I just thought, like, I don't want this to happen again. Like, I'm staying in this thing until it explodes. And I'm not going to end. I'm not going to quit. And I think this is a thing that you can do if you don't have large expenses on your own. I mean, I was bleeding cash. I was like very low on cash. I think I was down to like 30K of cash. And I think I paused my, no, I brought my income down to whatever was minimum wage for our health insurance at the time, which was like 30 something K, I think. And then I was burning cash, and I had only like a few months of money left. It was such a disaster. So if you have kids that you have to support, like you can't really do this then. Like it's too much stress. So I think starting a company in this way is a younger person's game, because as you get a little bit older, like you have more to lose. And I had a lot more energy then. At 43 now, like I can't do that now. But my bicycle really helped a lot. When I was really bad, I would hop on the bike and go riding for hours, like go ride up Mount Tam and go to like Tiburon and like just go ride like all over the place. And I would think about moves I can do. I would stop the bike and write down 4 things on my phone and email it to myself. And then I would like ride the bike more. And that was very helpful. And I still do a lot of that now. I still, I exercise like 6 days a week. I'm into like endurance running now. And I just, it is very helpful.
Running is a great way to clear your head. That's something I lean on a lot.
Anything that you do more than an hour is very helpful.
Yeah, it sounds like really obviously, I mean, to state the obvious, sounds like an extremely tough time. Obviously, so glad that you did not lean into some of those darker thoughts. And I'm glad you were able to find like interest, the meditation, the bike riding. Obviously, you had a friend that you were leaning on. So obviously, if anybody is listening and is going through some of those dark times, I would look to Chris as like an example, right?
Hey, you can reach out to me.
Better just, days are ahead.
Just send me a personal email. It's just chrisfed@gmail.com, and I'll hop on the phone. And someone actually reached out to me 3 weeks ago. It was in a very similar state. And it was a pretty tough conversation. But he said it helped him out like a lot. It gave him a lot of other... One thing I'm very good at is thinking of... is having lots of ideas. A lot of them tend to be... but there are a lot of them. So... I'm very good at brainstorming. So if anybody ever is short on ideas, I can probably have ideas.
Okay. I love that. I think that's so nice of you to offer your personal email like that and time. I mean, obviously if anybody's going through that, I think you're an inspiration that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And also, like, you know, even if Blackthorn did have to shut down, even though probably in those times it would have felt like it's the end of the world, I think you would probably agree now that it wouldn't have been, right? I mean,
it wouldn't have been, but wow, would it have been very painful?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good time to wrap up there, but I just want to ask, like, for anyone who's in very early days, just starting out either as a first-time founder, or maybe even brand new to the Salesforce ecosystem in general, do you have any advice that you'd like to share with them that you wish you had known when you were first starting out Blackthorn?
A lot of things, actually. The one that's more topical now is try to pick something that is very hard to make. Because with AI now, a lot of stuff is very easy and fast. To make. So whatever it is, try to go into an area that AI is not going to stomp you on quickly. Another one is try to build your own IP. Don't build an integration app unless you're becoming like a hub integrating to a million things, but there's already lots of those. That's important because people can displace you very fast. And yeah, another one, that the whole reason to get on the App Exchange is to have credibility. If you go to get installed in a big org and you don't have it through security review, I don't actually even know if they'll even like allow it. Mm-hmm. A big part of our SOC 2 that we've had to get through is like getting through the Salesforce security review. Okay, that's not a big part. It's a tenet of it. SOC 2 is very hard. It's very annoying. It's part of the go-to-market. It makes it a lot easier, but it will not grow your company. So depending upon the vertical, you got to figure out your own way to get leads, like cold calling, going to events, founder-led sales, if you have some kind of following, this, you know, all the stuff that you read about, but it's not going to come from the Salesforce partner manager.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks so much for your time today, Chris. If folks want to learn, I know you already shared your personal email, but if folks are interested in learning more about Blackthorn specifically, where can they go to learn about the company or reach out to you for
You can email, Blackthorn? Yeah, my work email is chris@blackthorn.io. Just ask us anything. I mean, if you want to learn more, just blackthorn.io.com. I wish we had the .com, sorry. Blackthorn.io, maybe it's wishful thinking. Yeah, just blackthorn.io. And we've got a ton of stuff there. Or you just email me. I'll get you connected to whomever. It's just chris@blackthorn.io.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much again, Chris. And best of luck to you and the team at Blackthorn.
Cool. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
Are you looking to connect with the most dedicated founders and builders in the Salesforce ecosystem? The AppAssemblyLine audience is made up of the exact ISV partners and entrepreneurs you're trying to reach. We're opening up a few sponsorship slots to partner with brands that can truly help our listeners succeed. If you're ready to connect with the leaders of the App Exchange, you can learn more at appassemblyline.com/sponsor. That's appassemblyline.com/sponsor.